23 July.
Great member, Miss O'Marion Forks.
Thank you.
Kurt Kramer is McKenzie.
Hey, Kurt.
Brian Harnish, PNNL.
All right. Hi, Ryan.
Red on floor, podium, shut me up.
You say
Red Boyd, South Denny of Ashby Foster.
Red. Was that John Thorpe?
It is.
Okay, thanks. Your voice sounded a little bit weird.
That's probably just I got my upper lip full of Novocaine from seeing the dentist this morning, so that's probably not working too good.
Yeah, you know, a way to make that go away quicker is drink really hot coffee.
Oh, yeah.
Just kidding. Somebody else just called in.
Hey, Dave, this is Tom.
Hey, hi, Tom. All right, we got a great group here. Let's just get rolling. I'm sure other folks will call in. I know that Cam Sharp is in a meeting. He said he'd call in after that, which is awesome. I'm sure there'll be a couple other folks. Chris Caudill, is he going to try to get on the phone at some point?
He will call. I'm going to call him before we talk about that and when we get to that data set.
Okay. Sounds good. All right. Guys, the desktop sharing is working, so you're welcome to use the agenda web meeting information and share the desktop. And what I've got up here right now is our agenda. And what I'm going to do is go over our May minutes real briefly, just some of the action items. And some of these are a little bit old, and most of them I think are completed, but there may be a couple outstanding ones, and maybe there's some new things that I haven't picked up. I don't know if folks had an opportunity to review the meeting minutes, and if you have, and if you see things that need to be corrected for the record or additions, whatever, please make changes in there and track changes and send them back, and we'll make sure we get that in the record. So, anyway, just kind of a heads up. Okay, so we're gonna go over the action items from the last May meeting, because we didn't have one in June, and then we're gonna do some updates from the program, Hatchery Program Managers. And following that, I'm gonna give a brief update on the Fall Creek Entrainment Study. I know that's probably more rightly belongs in the Fish Passage Team meeting, and I'd certainly be happy to update them as well, but I figured since I was a technical lead on that, I could give you guys the latest and greatest, and you know how we're planning on proceeding forward with that. Jeremy Apt, I think, is going to call in on the phone. He is the technical lead for the adult outplant site improvements work that has been going on for quite some time, and I know a number of you have met him. He provided a PowerPoint presentation that either he will give if he can call in, or I will give to you folks. And it's just kind of an overview of all the sites and some neat pictures and some interesting pictures. Anyhow, and the important thing is that most of these have been commissioned. We're planning on commissioning the Gold Creek site on Fall Creek next week. I believe it is July 29th. I'm trying to make sure I get the arrangements with the Core Valley folks, Greg Taylor and his crew, Doug Garless, Chad Helms. And that would be the final site to be commissioned. Having said their commission doesn't mean they're finalized, so don't get that confused, because there's been a number of issues that have been identified that we need to move forward on and work on improving those. Following that, Ryan's going to give us an update on some of the juvenile steelhead work he's been doing on the South San Diem. And I am personally looking forward to that, because I have kind of been out of the loop, and I'm sure you got all kinds of interesting data to share. And if we're actually on schedule, we'll take a quick break, and then we've got some time dedicated from 11:30 on till 2 or however long it takes to talk about steelhead, both winter and summer steelhead. We've been scratching at the surface of this issue for a long time, and it's of real interest to the Corps, obviously, given the fact that winter steelhead is part of the biological opinion, and we seem to not know a whole ton of information about it. So we thought we'd sort of dredge up everything we had to date on what ODF&W has done in the past with some of the summer steelhead work, any winter steelhead work, any proposals that have been out there, proposals that have been put forth, that have been shelved, really just sort of all-encompassing whatever we know about steelhead sort of thing. And along those lines, hopefully Chris Caudill is going to call in and share some of the work he's been doing.
Yeah, so we were doing the, we've done the genetics piece on the juveniles during our migration, and one of the things we're doing with the Willamette Falls tagging work this year was taking genetic samples throughout the entire run so we can type those fish. So he's been working that. He's going to give an overall update of the work that's been going on and then how they're progressing on that, because this is another big piece of the puzzle I think everybody's interested in seeing is what the genetic makeup is of those fish returning from, you know, the early returns in November all the way through the winter sea lab run.
Yeah, no, that's great. And you're right. It's pretty important work. So looking forward to hopefully hearing from him. So that is our agenda. And if folks have any other thoughts or additions, I'd be happy to throw them into that mix. Otherwise, I'm going to jump right into the action item from May. And again, you guys, please, I know you're all busy, but take a look at these notes if you get a chance. And if you see something that you're you'd like to have corrected for the record, let us know. So we have, I'm just kind of scanning down through these. And again, you guys, and for everybody on the phone, you can share the desktop that I've got set up by just using the information on the agenda. So you can see what I'm looking at, which is basically the action items. And I want to see some that haven't been resolved. I know there's been discussion for several meetings, and maybe this is done, and Chris, you can help me with this. Cameron was going to be preparing a spreadsheet of equipment needs for the various traps, and once that was up and once that was finally developed, we were going to determine if there was things that were still needed, what we needed, and see how we could go about helping procure some of that thing.
So I think the latest on that was we went through that line by line at the last meeting, and some items have been, or all the items have been procured that needed to be procured. So all we really need to do is finalize that. It's final. We just need to post it on the website.
Okay. That's great. I'm glad to hear that. The other thing that Cameron's going to look into, and he's obviously not on the phone yet, maybe Tom has some information on this, is we had talked about Horn Creek, a weir operation there to remove fish, or at least stop fish from entering into that area. These hatchery fish that are put into the North Sandyam. And I think Cameron was going to work on something along those lines, but we're...
Yeah, Dave, this is Tom. He sent out a... He's got that drafted up, and he sent it out internally for review, looks like yesterday.
Okay.
So as soon as we get a look at it, he'll send that to you folks, and yeah, he'll be on in about an hour to talk about it.
Good. All right. Let's see, what else? The next item on here is adult release site commissioning. Okay, we did that. Yeah, I was just trying to get everybody's schedule, and again, I already summarized that, which we pretty much have gone through the commissioning exercise with the exception of Fall Creek, and anybody's welcome to go along on that Fall Creek site visit. Again, it's that Gold Creek site is one that is used by the Corps for outplanting Fall Creek fish, so it's not necessarily an ODF&W responsibility, but you guys are certainly welcome to come along on the ride and see what it looks like. By the way, that site is nothing more than taking that upper site on Fall Creek, where a little tributary called Gold Creek runs in, and there was an existing dirt road bed there. I think actually it was asphalt at one point that had been eroded by high water events, and the Corps has gone in there and put a nice concrete driveway, if you will, so you can back the truck right up to it. In fact, I've got a nice picture of it in this presentation later on. And then, let's see, a couple more here. Steelhead work group, something Bob has been working on passionately. You want to talk about it for a minute?
Yeah, I do. Well, is Lance on the phone?
Lance emailed me early this morning, said that he would not be calling in.
So there is some support, and really what we want to start doing is reviewing the data that we have, right? Seeing what the data means, and based on the results of the data we're meeting, what potential actions are available for us to take. There's clearly some RPA measures that cite this, and proposals going forward, there's been some pushback on pulling this meeting and getting it together. regardless of that, the first step is to review the data. We'll begin that today. I was hoping, and I'll let Chris speak to the genetic data later, because like I said before, I think everybody realizes how critical the genetic information is. We'll start reviewing that, but of course, some of these things take time to process. We just started collecting data this past year. So we'll see where we're at there, and based on the type of information we get presented today, I think we'll shape the next meeting, and it may be as part of RM&E, our home, where we continue to review the available information we have to start planning potential actions we could take.
All right. Thanks, Bob. The final issue was the TDG issue below Big Cliff, and I agree, Grand Admiral is going to follow up with Lance and Elise Kelly and try to figure out what to do fish disposition-wise when TDG is high. I suspect that's no longer an issue, but it was earlier in the year. And Greg, do you have any information on that or anybody from ODF&W since Lance is not on the phone?
Yeah, I mean, we just kind of watch the gauge site and look at what the flows are trending to be, but it's obviously hard to trend that when you're putting Chinook up in May and June and know what's going to happen in September when they spill the reservoir. So.
Right. So, did you come up with an alternative plan? That's really good. It's a good point you bring up. But
We decided we're going to have to take out both Big Cliff and Detroit Dams and solve that problem.
All right. Well, we'll note that in the notes. And
just one of those. I'm not sure how you'd ever predict it or change it or.
And actually, I could speak to that a little. One of the major drivers of that high TDG was the fact that the turbine unit was out for maintenance, so we had to spill, which means high gas levels. Previously, that period of time was determined to be kind of the least impact period. However, we're exploring other periods that may be better to do our turbine maintenance on an annual basis. However, even if we weren't doing the turbine maintenance, we probably would have still seen high gas levels just because of the amount of flow and the capacity of the turbine unit. So that's kind of where we're going in terms of the O&M side of things.
All right. Thanks. Question for you, Chris. Is turbine maintenance an annual thing?
It is. And at Big Cliff, we have one unit. So
right.
When we take that out, we have to use the spill light.
So then you're spilling.
And so there is a concept paper that's being solicited for this year assessing the problem, and the fix may be as easy as installing flip lips in the Big Cliff spillway, right? And in fact, it may be as cheap as conducting the study as solving the problem.
Yeah.
It's an issue with gas with spill.
Is the concept study more biological or engineering?
It's biological to see, basically, because what you have is, when you've got juveniles downstream migrating through and they're active migrants, typically they're not in the area of effect very long. However, when you've got fish spawning and rearing down below, there's depth compensation, there's eggs, there's a variety of different issues and different life stages that can be affected. And so assessing how bad the problem is kind of where this concept paper is at. But it can also recommend an overview of the problem. It may be cheaper just to install the flip lifts than to do the complete assessment and try and mitigate for the problem.
Sounds like a good solution, other than removing the dams. But that was the, I just covered all the action items, folks. Anybody on the phone have any other action items you can think of we might want to address or have not addressed? Okay. I will take your silence as concurrence. All right, yeah, hey, thank you. And again, if you get a chance to review the notes, let us know if you want to have some other thoughts, changes in there. Oh, wow. Okay, I'm going to give you, it's the hatchery manager's time to give us an update on what's going on at the various facilities. Greg, do you want to start?
Sure. Up at Marion Forks, they've been busy trying to get all the surrogate releases out with size and places they want to liberate to. The first group of three has gone out. They're working on the second group, trying to figure out size and timing. And Tom, if you want to talk about that after I'm done, you can talk about that. But it's know, just sometimes a struggle with size and getting the marking trailers and everything all aligned. But Chris says he's got it under control. So the only other issue up there is the Puzzle Creek fire, or it's called the Bingham fire, still burning. With a little bit of containment. This area burned about 4 years ago, but we've been on standby for about a week. There's a blaze in the upper Puzzle Creek. Puzzle Creek is a major tributary of Marion Creek, which feeds the hatchery. Puzzle Creek runs around 38 to 42 degrees and chills Marion Creek, so that's the reason the hatchery can survive. Right now, Marion Creek above Puzzle's about 73 degrees, so Puzzle's a real main artery of Marion Creek, keeping the water cold and usable. So that fire's burning in the upper reaches. It's hasn't dropped too far down in the basin. It's just kind of burning on the top of the edges. We have all kinds of contingency plans and pumps and people and trucks if we have to evacuate fish. Last Tuesday, we came real close to pulling the trigger on moving some fish, but so far have been lucky and haven't had to do that. So anyway, the fire is continuing to burn a little east today, which is where we want it. We don't want it to go southwest with this marine air coming in and some cool weather. They're hoping to have a line around it today and would call it about 60% contained if they could do that today. So as far as Minto, collection continues to go pretty strong. We're a little over 1,800 Chinook, 1,400 steelhead. We saw our first lamprey last Thursday and have seen another one today. They have made it to the top step of the ladder, but they're not able to maneuver around the finger weir. There's a couple of edges or ledges there that they try to jump around, and we just have not seen them successful going around that. So we'll talk amongst ourselves and see if we can find a ramp or some other way to get them into the pre-sort. But those are the first two I've seen in the 23 years I've been here. So
wow.
News that they can make it up the ladder. We're just right now stuck at the top step, and that's about it.
I'm wondering if we want to look into some sort of trap. I don't know if that's possible or not. Versus just having lamprey go into the pre-sort. I don't know. Just a thought to keep in mind.
Yeah, I don't want to look too at, kind of doing a rebuild on the on the finger weir and actually making a finger weir. We still are having fish jump out of that back end because it doesn't have fingers. But yeah, sort of, some sort of a ramp or something that they could get over, and then fingers that fish don't lead to would be a fix.
So would then they be placed up above like the wild Chinook then?
Yeah, our protocol would be, anything migrating through the pre-sort would be passed above. We had run it under the pit scanner because I think there was some at Willamette Falls that were pit tagged. So we'd run them through that and put them upriver. I don't know if we want to tag them so we know if there's fallback or anything, but right now I don't have any direction to do that.
All right. Thanks. Anybody, any questions for Greg?
Does Lawrence typically, Schwabi, typically sit on this call?
Lawrence,
because I'm sure he'd be interested. I don't know if he's been made aware.
Lawrence used to participate in all these. I don't know if he's gotten called away to other things or maybe their staff is thin. I don't know. But the tribes used to be pretty active in this meeting and haven't seen him for quite a while. But
well, I'll take an action.
He's on our list.
Yeah, I'll take an action item and give him a heads up. Give him a call. Give him a heads up.
Hey, Tom, do you want to speak real quickly, follow up, Greg, and talk about surrogates?
Yeah, so, Greg, you're referring to the paired release fish? Greg?
paired release, sorry.
Yeah. So the bulk of those fish, the smaller ones, were liberated on July 9th. And they've been seen at various points, including the new Bennett pit tag array, over the past couple weeks. So there's about 33,000 released in three different locations on July 9th. And then what's left there at the hatchery are the larger fish, or the fish that are intended to be larger for John Beeman's experiment. They are pit tagged, and then they're going to get active tags, about 10,000 fish each, and they'll be released later this month.
Cool.
Then we've also got the group of the first ever group of steelhead there that will be released probably next spring.
Tom, I thought we'd had the pair release set for some of those to go this fall. Is it because the timing of when we're going to potentially lose the Spillway Crest at Detroit that we're not going to release the group?
Yeah, I guess we hadn't completely settled on the timing. It could be fall or it could be spring, and it just depends on, if you want to release the fish when they have an opportunity to exit, or if you want to release them at a time that is closer to when naturally produced fish, if they were up there, would be passing through the reservoir. So probably merits a little bit further discussion, but yeah, we're thinking November would probably be my first choice, but if not then in spring.
Yeah, because November we will be well below crest. Stuart, do you think we got the fish passage team meeting next week? We've got this on the agenda to talk about the survival study. Should we have a kind of a discussion around this issue as well?
Yeah, I think that'd be good.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, thank you. If there's no further questions for Greg or Tom, we'll go to Brett Boyd.
At the South City Ham Hatchery, everything's going well. Steelhead marked, everything's split out. We completed kind of the first phase of the old adult holding pond conversion, got bird netting and juvenile screening in the pond, and have transferred 300,000 Chinook over that we would have normally waited to bring over in November. So they're here now and doing really well. And other than that, it's kind of business as usual. As far as foster trap goes, everything's going good over there. It's kind of ODSW officially took over July 1. Still some of the contractors on site finishing up those, so they've been a big help. Trying to get some of the minor tweaks and a few of the final adjustments made on some of the equipment. Fish movement's been fairly slow. A lot of fish holding below the dam, but they just, I guess, just kind of not wanting to come in. For Chinook, we've had 1,704 fish total, 1,429 news, or hatchery fish, 274 no marks. All of the unmarked fish have been outplanted above foster. We've had 143 go to River Bend, 45 go to Calkins, and 94 go to Gordon Road. We're done with the River Bend site now. It's because due to the low water, so everything will be going to Calkins or Gordon Road. And Summer Steelhead, we've had 2,390 new fish, and we'll be recycling recycling ends August 1st, so that's about completed. And we continue to take brood. And everything's been working pretty good over there, actually, though, as far as just equipment. So everything's going good.
Good. Hey, I know there was a couple tweaks made at the Gordon Road site. Is that working pretty well? Are you satisfied that it's working pretty well?
Yeah, they moved the pipe away from that boulder, so
right.
That was the main concern. They kind of widened the parking lot out a little bit. The only thing is, I don't know what's going to happen, but the piece of flex pipe that they had inside the tube for us is just too heavy and too stiff to maneuver and get onto the truck, so we're actually just using the old one that we had used prior to having the new site. So I don't know if they're going to provide another piece of pipe or if that's something we're going to purchase, so we'll just have to kind of work that out.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping Jeremy comes on later to speak to this. I do know that he's working with a number of these types of issues. Obviously some of that pipe that he originally installed was quite heavy duty, and he designed it purposely like that, but I don't think he was quite aware that it takes, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger to maneuver that stuff. So,
yeah, no kidding.
Yeah. Well, at least it won't be vandalized, at least we hope.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, we got everything's locked, and so hopefully that
that doesn't occur again.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks. I appreciate that, Brett. And if Jeremy, I think he is a little aware of these issues, but if not, we'll make sure that he is. Any questions for Brett on the South Sandium? Okay, John Thorpe, are you the surrogate for Dan Peck?
Oh, no.
Oh. Well, you are now.
No.
Yep. Do you have any?
I know he's things have been going fairly well as far as I know. All my conversations with him have been in his upcoming construction stuff, but got lots of fish this time. Water temperature came up to about 60 degrees up at the hatchery, well, it was a week ago when weather was hot, and so that was kind of concerning him, but obviously this weather has cooled things back off, so things are just operating pretty much normal.
Yeah. Do you know the returns to date
No, but I know we were selling fish up until a week ago.
Wow.
Without looking at those numbers, every time they worked the trap, they were handling over 1,000 fish.
My. Okay. Well, at some point it'd be good to get an update, numbers-wise at least, from the from Dexter. Okay. All right. Well, thanks. Thanks, John. Kurt Kremers, you're the only one left. How are things going down there on the McKenzie?
Oh, all right. Fish collection, adult collection, it's going to be below average. We averaged about 4,000 over the last 10 years anyway, and last year was 2,500, and if we hit 2,500 this year, I'll be pleasantly surprised.
Mm.
So it's looking a little bit different. But part of that is, though, we do have 375 females on hand for brood stock, so we're in good shape there. But I'm concerned about Cougar and Trailbridge getting fish up there. I have 135 pair on hand for the South Fork, but what I understand, they're having a very difficult time collecting fish up there too.
Yep.
So we may be putting everything we can from here up there. Just to supplement what they have. But looking at past history, you know, we could get 18% of the females of the run in September, but still, at this time, that would only be about 110 fish.
Yeah. So, Kurt, of the 2,500, are some of those collected from Leeburg, the trap, or are they just all volunteers to the facility?
Well, this year, we've only gotten 12 from Leeburg.
Okay. And of those 2,500, do you know roughly the ratio of male-female?
I can tell you pretty quickly.
All right, thank you.
So those are 2,500 from last year, too.
Yeah.
Okay, so... Well, there's 1,376 males, 974 females, and 159 jacks.
Okay. And you do incorporate jacks into your hatchery, right, into the brood?
We do put some in there, yeah.
Okay.
But that's 38-39% were females.
Yeah, that's
the whole run.
We've been evaluating those historic ratios, you know, as part of the McKenzie HGMP, and they are... They're definitely skewed towards males.
Yeah, they are. And right now we're, let's see here. It's kind of funny, this year we're running 38% females. So we've got 567 females in here so far this year. Mm-hmm. The 1,477 that we've gotten in here.
Yeah.
So we have had 21 unmarked fish. Those have all been taken over to the Greenwood Bull Ramp behind us here. We had one of those fish come back to the hatchery, and it was taken back out there. Our mark ratio is 98.2%.
Okay.
Having a fin clip, so we're running real high there.
Yeah.
And, we've only gotten 12 fish from Leeburg Hatchery, none from Leeburg Dam, which is kind of typical. We start getting those more in August and September.
Right.
So, but there are some concerns whether or not we can meet even the 400 females for the South Fork.
Right.
So we'll see how this all pans out, but there is some concern there.
Yeah. Well, thank you. We'll stay tuned.
So last month before, we talked about Cogswell Creek, the pipeline probably had a break in the pipeline. That has been repaired. It was back online July 14th, but was offline for 10 weeks.
Wow.
So from May 10th to July 14th. So we didn't have any Cogswell influence for collection all that time. I don't think it would have made a huge difference anyway. The river dropped to pretty low levels fairly early in the collection, where our attraction is boosted up because of the low river level. So
yeah,
we probably did pretty well anyway, but still a concern. But it is back in line online, and we will try to adjust the outflow at the end of the fish ladder sometime soon. We want to get something in place before the next movement of fish in September to narrow up that that outfall, so that we can kind of jet the water out there a little bit better, and hopefully it works for even better collection.
Yeah, I know that John Thorpe and I had talked about that a while ago. I thought that was put in place, but you're still working on it?
Well, the problem was, Dave, that when the pipeline was broke up there at Cogswell, we couldn't turn our water off or inundate the work site.
Oh, I see.
So all that time, we couldn't even do that. Otherwise, we would have done it. But we were afraid of water backing up the pipeline and then inundating the work site.
All right, right.
Not just afraid of it. I know it would have happened. So we couldn't do anything for a while there. Right now, I'm waiting to get one of our local folks here to help me dive the end of the fish ladder so they can clear out the area. We already have dam boards on hand. Neil Rash, one of our guys over at the screen shop, is visiting with me hopefully tomorrow, and we can get some more measurements taken so we can move forward. But it's just been delayed. It was delayed really by EWIP quite a bit, but hey, that's the way it goes.
All right. Well, we've got that in the notes. EWIP's fault.
There you go.
And they paid for the repair, correct?
They did.
Who paid for it?
ODM&W paid for those repairs, didn't they?
Well, that is what the plan is so far.
I mean, EWIP hasn't, they didn't offer, did they?
They did not.
But they did indicate that it was their trucks that caused the damage?
Well, when I mentioned to the engineer I talked with that this probably is not a coincidence, he agreed.
Yeah.
But there's been no we did it kind of thing. Yeah. So
jumping up and down saying
Yeah, they helped at the very beginning, giving us a little bit of excavation to get down to the pipeline, which was 2 hours of work, and after that it's been kind of frustrating. But anyway, it's prepared now, it's working, and we've got it back online.
Good deal. Good job.
Any idea how much it cost?
You know, I am not sure. John might be able to give you a little bit more info about that.
Okay.
We're thinking, as Terry told me, he thinks now it's up to about $30,000.
Holy smoke.
Okay.
Well, I mean, you know, VWeb delayed us for a whole month asking for new things. We had to order parts out of Canada for special grip straps and lug nuts. And we had it finished three or four times, and every time VWeb would say, oh, no, we'd like it designed this way, so we had to tear it apart. So
okay.
It was a complicated process. It should have been done in about 2 days. And instead, every time we'd get done, then VWeb would put a new set of requirements on us that they hadn't told us about. Mm. And it would require some fancy little widgets. In fact, the final one, we actually had to cut it back apart again and install some caps that we had imported from someplace up in Canada so that we could pressure test the steel pipe so that then we could take the caps back off and hook it back up to the concrete pipe. You couldn't pressure test and get the flow going. And, you know, it was an exercise in EWEB regulation. So
right.
they were not what I would call a big help in doing this, and probably cost us $10,000 to $12,000.
I'm confused a little bit. Why was EWEB so engaged if they did not accept, you know, any responsibility for it, didn't pay anything, and it's not on their land, is it?
Oh, it is. It crosses the Lieber Canal.
Oh, there we go. Okay.
And that's their water to that power plant downstream. And and then that was why it had to be pressure tested, because they've got a rule that says anything that crosses the canal
has to meet 100 PSI.
Okay.
You know, you guys have worked with the Corps of Engineers. You gotta know these things. but it's done now.
We'd still be planning on it. We'd be in the planning phase.
Now we can move forward. Yeah.
Do you need help from us?
we'd be forming a team, John.
I got to use my opportunities to poke at people.
Yeah, thank you. All right, hey, thanks. Appreciate your input. Anything else, Kurt?
With our reduction in our production, we've been able to set up a density study thing that Cameron Sharp and I have started applying to ponding of our fish. Our fish are being marked right now, and we're almost done with that. We should be done possibly the end of the week, but maybe another couple days of next week. And we've been able to spread those fish out a little bit thinner in density so that fish health-wise should be even better. So, so that's one other thing that we're doing. And other than that, things are going along fairly smooth.
Cool. All right. Thanks. Hey, up on my desktop, I have an update from Greg Taylor. He sent this morning on both Fall Creek and Cougar, since we were speaking about Cougar earlier. And how many of you are looking at, I'll just read it real quickly. So at Fall Creek to date, 446 unmarked Chinook and 5 hatchery Chinook have returned to Fall Creek. And of those unmarked, interestingly enough, it's almost exactly, it's 221 males, 220 females, so it's 50-50 ratio there. For comparison, we had a total count of 482 Chinook to the facility in 2013, but only 13 returned to the facility after this date last year. It appears that the numbers for this year and last year will be nearly identical. To date, 104 Chinook and 4 bull trout have returned to Cougar. 55 males, 45 females, and 4 marked females. This year to date, count at Cougar was 148, so as you said, we're lower on the McKenzie in general. Lamprey ramp has been, and trap has been installed at Fall Creek, and it's been fishing for quite a while now, and according to his notes, no lamprey have been captured to date. If you've got any questions, you can certainly email Greg about what's going on there. And if there's no questions about that, we'll move on. Let's see, where's my agenda? All right, thanks you guys for the hatchery updates. Anybody have any final questions for the managers? Somebody else may have just joined us on the phone.
It's Cameron.
Hey, Cameron. We just got done with the hatchery program updates. And on the agenda, we're moving on to a brief update on the Fall Creek entrainment study. So you guys, I think all of you had seen the report for 13 let me back up just a sec. So because we're updating the adult fish facility at Fall Creek, and because we use the fish horns as our water supply intake for the fish facility that are all unscreened, since they were originally designed to pass juvenile fish downstream, it was recommended by the agencies, and we agreed to do an entrainment study to try to get a sense of how many fish are actually being entrained in that facility. And we built last year we built a little entrainment live car box and started sampling almost at the very end of May. We call it the beginning of June, and the facility had been operating since about mid-March is when it opens up every year. So last year in 13, because the contract was let a little bit late and the entrainment monitoring device was built, and it took some time with the contractor, we got up and running a little bit late. But you all saw the results of that report that I sent out at the end of last year. And the bottom line was, and we had marked a number of hatchery fish and surrogate fish and thrown them in the reservoir in that late May period so we could monitor some easily identifiable marked fish as well as any hatch, as well as any wild fish that left the reservoir. And after sampling throughout the entire fish facility operation period in 13 and shuts down in mid-October, we then compiled the results and took a look, and what we found was that we were in training, oh gosh, I've got the report sitting here. I think it was on the order of 0.176% of the fish or something like that were being entrained. A very low number. 1.76, I'm sorry. So yeah, in 2013, juvenile Chinook captured included 162 wild fish, which translated to 1.76% or 1.759%, depending on what calculation you used. And the reason I'm saying that is because ODF&W, Bernadette, had reviewed our report from 13 and had some questions and issues about the calculation we used for defining entrainment. And she suggested that we try another calculation, which we did, and we applied that, and actually, as you can see, it changed from 1.761 to 1.759%. So it really didn't change much. But anyways, we thank ODF&W for that input. So the bottom line was in 13 we had a very, very low percent of wild fish entrained, and even lower percentage of our tagged marked fish were entrained. And then in 14, we started up the entrainment study commensurate with the beginning of the fish facility operations in mid-March, because we wanted to capture that spring period. There was concern that we were missing a lot of the fish were being entrained in that early spring period. They're out migrating then, and we may not have seen them. And so we wanted to capture at least an entire year of operation. And we did that and started it on the day the fish facility went into operation. Operated it through the end of June, I believe, or I'm sorry, sometime around the June 11th or something, at which point we summarized that data and sent it out to folks to look at. And I don't know if you guys are looking at what I've got on the screen, but there's a nice picture of our entrainment basket. It's pretty cool. Works really well. Samples 100% of the fish. Some of the interesting things we found were, and this occurred in both years, the peak migration period actually occurred in May and June. So there was, as I said, there was concern that maybe in that March-April time frame, a bunch of fish were moving through. And I'll get to those results in for 14. There actually were very, very few fish. In fact, no fish moved at all in April. When I say the peak migration, even though it sounds like it's a peak, it's a really low number. Here's a comparison of 13 and 14. And you can see really the trends were the same, that June was the peak of out-migration. May and June. And April, we had no fish that moved through any of the horns and were entrained into the evaluator. March, we had just a couple. So again, we summarized those results for 14 and sent them out for review, and because we have a situation where if we're going to be required or need to screen any of those fish horns, Natalie Richards, who's the project manager, needs to incorporate the cost of that into a budget. And of course, we have to have an entire process, as you guys know, to start the design phase. And she was really concerned about the timing of that, you know, interfering with the construction of the adult upstream facility. And so we wanted to engage the agencies in a conversation about, hey, how's the data look? I mean, the core sense was the numbers are really, really low, and they are. But we wanted to make sure that folks were comfortable with our idea that the numbers that so far to date have been entrained are so low that it'd be a really tough argument to try to sell to, you know, spend potentially up several million dollars to screen these horns for, you know, a couple of hundred fish. And NIMS had written back to us, oh, maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, and in essence concurred with that finding, that basically the numbers were so low that at this point they didn't see a need for us to screen. And Stephanie, in her letter, and you guys may have all seen it, she raised some interesting questions about what happens in the reservoir with the wild fish behavior. I think they're all very good questions. You know, what are they doing there? Because they're being held there a long period of time. And then, you know, the bulk of them move through the RO during the deep drawdown in late fall, early winter. Is that good or bad? She just asked some questions that I thought would be good at some point in the future to potentially, you know, look at some R&E efforts to try to get a better sense of what is going on with fish behavior in the reservoir, but I know some of that work has actually been done in the past. But for purposes of what we're trying to accomplish, which is do we need to screen or not, NIMS has given us concurrence, at least in that letter, and the Corps is in the process of formalizing a letter and sending back to them just to make sure that there's no confusion. In the meantime, we've also agreed to continue to monitor evaluation of the trap throughout the operation of the fish facility up until the point where we actually tear down the old facility and rebuild the new one. So we're going to get at least 2 more years of data, another year and a half of data from that facility. And if we see something different than we have seen today, we'll certainly report that immediately to the agencies and engage them. It's my hope we don't. It appears that fish don't use those horns. They don't like the horns. They can't find them, whatever. So, their original design purpose to pass them didn't work very well. And that was evidenced in some of the earlier reports that ODFMW had done. And then finally, I guess in conclusion, the fish that were in train, we were, for purposes of the study, we evaluated their injury and that type of thing and held them over for 24 and 48 hours to look at delayed mortality. But for all intents and purposes, we were essentially writing these fish off. They were pretty well hammered. A lot of eye injuries, a lot of hemorrhaging of the eyes. And, even though there was a fairly high number that survived over 48 hours, they may not have survived one more day in the river. So, again, it was really more of an exercise in let's evaluate their injury. But we weren't trying to argue at the table that, hey, look, there's 16 more fish that survived for 2 days. So just wanted to make sure people were aware of that.
Yeah, because the point is, if it's an auxiliary water supply, any fish that enter in there are not going to survive, so it's a write-off.
Yeah. They've got a rough ride. You guys all probably are familiar with that project and those pipes. And it was interesting, though, because some of the hatchery rainbow trout, I think they were hatchery. Some of these bigger fish, 12 inches on up, they took that ride quite well. Even though they were physically mangled, they looked like they were hardy little buggers. I mean, they were holding over, for 2 days pretty well. And, of course, bullheads and other, bullheads, you could run them through 16 times and they'd be fine. But anyhow, that's sort of irrelevant. So I just wanted to summarize that data for you folks so you knew what the Corps' plan is now to write a formal letter to NIMS requesting their concurrence that we do not need to screen at this time. And we'll continue to evaluate, and if we see anything, we'll let folks know. That way, Natalie Richards can get on with her project of rebuilding this fish facility, which is going to be pretty awesome. Does anybody have any questions? Okay. All right, so good. Our next agenda item then is an update from PNNL, Ryan Harnish, who's hopefully still on the phone and is stuck with us.
Yes, I am.
Good, thank you. We contracted with PNNL, this is their second year now, to take a look at the summer and winter juvenile steelhead interactions in the South Santiam. And Jeff McMichaels, as you guys know, was the head scientist on that study, and I think it was maybe 2 months ago now, Ryan, or a month and a half ago, he left PNNL after a long, successful career and joined some small consulting firm over in the area of Washington. I think it's burning down now, but hopefully things are going okay. So, Ryan, I'm going to just go ahead and turn it over to you, and you can tell folks what the objectives and goals of the second-year study was and what you've been doing to date.
Okay. So last year we had a couple different objectives. First off, we implanted 200 fish at South Santiam Hatchery with radio tags. 100 of those fish were released volitionally, and 100 were released at off-site locations. And then we used the data collected by the University of Idaho, their fixed receiver stations set up throughout the Santiam, South Santiam River, and Willamette Falls to track the progress of those fish and determine what proportion of them were leaving the river and how long they were hanging around. So to try to get a sense for the rate of residualization of those hatchery fish from the South Annie Am. And then we also wanted to look at behavioral interactions. So of the fish that residualize, what are their interactions with wild fish? So we did some direct observations, snorkeling surveys to observe hatchery and wild fish interacting, and kept track of interaction rates and the fish that initiated the interaction and which one dominated and all those sorts of things. What we found last year was a very high percentage of fish never leaving the hatchery. I believe it was 28% of our tagged fish, of the volitional fish, never left the hatchery. And we also had pretty high rates of residualization in the river of those that did leave the hatchery. About 60% never left the, or were never detected in the Willamette River. However, we didn't do any fate determination last year to figure out if those fish were still alive, if the radio tagged fish were still alive in the river, or whether they had died. And also, we used a 4-gram tag last year, and we think that that might have had some effect on the fish's behavior, because the proportion of the radio tagged fish that remained in the hatchery was much higher than the untagged population. So we think that that might have had some negative effects on our results. We did observe in the behavioral aspect of it that, like you would expect, the larger hatchery fish typically dominated the interactions with wild fish. We didn't observe a whole lot of interactions between hatchery and wild fish, probably somewhere around 10 different interactions between different hatchery fish and groups of wild fish, so the sample size there is fairly small. So this year we wanted to do a similar study using smaller radio tags and do some mobile tracking to get a fate determination of the fish that didn't leave the river, and then to try some manipulation experiments where once we encountered a group of wild fish interacting with with the hatchery fish, we were going to try to angle the hatchery fish from its location and then try to observe the response of the wild fish to determine whether or not the hatchery fish was occupying optimal foraging location and therefore having a negative competitive interaction on the wild fish. So far to date, we tagged 200 fish at the hatchery. 164 of those left the hatchery volitionally, so only 18% remained at the hatchery, which was much lower than what we observed last year. The mobile tracking we did last week, Cam was nice enough to loan us a raft for a few days last week, so we were able to float the river from Foster down to Waterloo Park. And University of Idaho loaned us a receiver, so lots of nice cooperation going on there. And we detected 33 fish between Foster and Waterloo, 20 of which were still alive, most of those being pretty close to the hatchery. I think, 12 of the 20 fish that were still alive were less than about a half a mile from the hatchery. 9 of the 33 fish or tags that we detected were no longer alive or no longer in living fish, and 4 were unknown. So the 20 fish still alive represents about 12% of those that actually left the hatchery. So fairly low percent of residualization relative to what we observed last year. As far as the sample surveys, we have made 2 trips to attempt to observe behavioral interactions, and we focused most of our efforts around Waterloo Park and McDowell Creek Bridge area, which is where we focused most of our efforts last year, just to stay away from all the fishermen up by the hatchery, and there's really not a whole lot of good access points upstream of McDowell Creek Bridge, where there's also, you know, easily accessible ripples in which you can observe juvenile steelhead. So we focused our efforts down around Waterloo and McDowell Creek Bridge, similar to last year, and this year we had to search high and low to try to find any hatchery fish hanging out in those areas. And we got a little bit of information from one hatchery steelhead interacting with wild fish, so we're going to try to focus our next efforts on the area between Foster and Pleasant Valley to see if we can find a few more hatchery fish to observe. And we are still waiting to get our collection permit from State of Oregon to be able to do those manipulation experiments, and hopefully we'll be getting that soon. I just heard back, answered some additional questions that they had, so hopefully we'll be getting that in the next week or so, and then we will proceed with some of those manipulations if we can find the right kind of scenario of hatchery fish interacting with wild fish. So in general, it seems that we're seeing a lot fewer residual hatchery steelhead hanging out in the river. Not sure if that's partially caused by the reduction in tag size, and that's why we're seeing the lower percentage of our radio tag fish hanging out in the river. But from what we've seen snorkeling, it would also appear that there's just fewer hatchery steelhead in the river compared to last year. So I don't know if anyone, I was curious to talk to Brett if they did anything different with the steelheads this year that might have made them leave sooner. I looked at the flows around the time of release, and the flows were actually higher and increasing last year when they opened the gates, and this year they were a bit lower and on the decline. So I didn't think that had anything to do with it, but maybe Brett has some ideas.
No, we followed the same procedures as last year. I think the main thing is just probably the tag size.
Yeah, I'm sure that has a big effect. We used 4-gram tags last year and 2-gram tags this year, so I'm sure that has a lot to do with it. But even our snorkeling efforts, I mean, we would get in a ripple last year and not have too much trouble finding a hatchery steelhead hanging out to watch. And this year it's been a challenge.
I know the flows just in general in the South NAM have been higher all season long than they were last year as well. If you look at the USGS graph, earlier on in the season it was averaging 200 to 300 CFS higher, and even right now it's at least 100 CFS higher than it was last year. I think they're planning on doing some work at Green Peter or something, so they're drafting a little more water through the system. Hmm.
Well, and that sounds somewhat contrary to what Ryan just said. So.
But I think what Ryan was just saying is earlier on at the time of release, but when you look at the...
Oh, in general, okay.
In general, yeah, we've definitely been much higher flows. I mean, we didn't drop down to below 1,000 CFS till end of July.
Oh, gotcha.
This year, yeah. It stayed up around 1,400 all of June.
Yeah.
So there's a solution. We just need to dump Green Peter every year.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's what the solution is, to help, you know, put more water down there and push them out. Well, yeah, it sounds like good news in terms of the lack of seeing hatchery summer steelhead in there.
Because that was one of the results last year. I mean, we looked at the tag bird and the tag dead body mass,
yep.
And said, yeah, that probably influenced those results. But the thing that was really important to me was when they started talking about how many residual hatchery fish right. They just saw out there that weren't tagged.
Right, right, right. Well, so it sounds like you've got planned another snorkel survey in a different location, so we'll be curious to see. Hopefully you'll see the same thing. Very, very few hatchery fish around.
Yeah. Another thing that we've noticed, too, is, similar to last year, most of the hatchery fish or most of the radio tag hatchery fish that seemed to stay in the river were never detected at Pleasant Valley, so they were between the hatchery and Pleasant Valley. Most of the fish that we mobile tracked, let's see, 25 out of 33 were upstream of Pleasant Valley. So relatively few of them are still hanging around downstream from Pleasant Valley. So even, you know, if there are some hatchery fish hanging around, if they're pretty localized, they maybe aren't having a real large effect on the wild population just because they're so concentrated around the hatchery.
Yeah.
I got in and snorkeled around the hatchery outflow pipe and the fish ladder entrance last week and did see probably 20 to 30 hatchery steelhead juveniles hanging out around there. But, you know, what kind of effect they're having on any wild fish is probably pretty small because, you know, it's not great habitat for a wild fish to be hanging out in.
Yeah. They're probably waiting for food.
Hey, Brent, how does that 18% staying rate compare to what you see in untagged fish?
Not really comparable. We usually only about less than a percent of what we see stay in the ponds of the hatchery. Hmm.
So, Ryan, follow-up question on your snorkeling. You say you didn't see many summer steelhead, but did you see many wild steelhead out there, or, you know, Oncorhynchus out there?
Yeah, quite a few. Just about every ripple you get into, you see something, you know, depending on the size of the ripple, but normally you'll see 15 to 20 of them, sometimes way more than that.
And what kind of size classes are we talking here?
For the wild Omicus, you know, they're probably the low end is around 100 millimeters, up to probably 200, 250 millimeters.
And what I'm just wondering is, were they produced above Foster or below Foster, and kind of origin? Because if they were below Foster, you know, probably the result of their hatchery F1. But if they were produced above Foster, much better chance that they will have a wild origin.
Yeah.
I'd say most of the fish or most of the unclipped Omicus are, you know, closer to the 4 to 6 inch range, probably.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ryan. Any questions from folks on the phone for Ryan? Ken, any questions?
No.
All right, hey, thank you so much. Appreciate it. I jumped over a agenda item, and I didn't know if Jeremy App was on the phone. Jeremy, are you on the phone? Okay. Jeremy was dealing with a leaking pipe at his house, I believe. So I'm going to go ahead and just cover that the adult health plan slideshow that he gave folks. He sent to me, or he was going to actually present. And you guys are welcome to join in if you are up on the web meeting. And it's just kind of a bit of a slideshow here. I don't exactly know what he was going to speak to, so I'm going to sort of walk through it. But as I said, he's a technical lead on this project, and I was helping out as a fish bio. So sites above Detroit Dam, and we've got Gordon Road site, a USGS site, and the Villa Maria site. The USGS and Villa Maria are both on the Brighton Bush. And Gordon Road?
Gordon's on the south
Gordon
side.
Road, sorry. Typo.
That should be Cooper's Ridge.
Yeah. Never mind. So I should have looked at this before I started reading it. Anyways, we've seen all of these sites. The Villa Maria site had some issues. It was built in the Brighton Bush, near that Brighton Bush Hot Springs area. And it was based on the fact that's some pretty good habitat upstream of that area. Unfortunately, in between the time the planning went in and the actual construction took place, some high flow events sort of moved the river around a bit. And as you'll see in a picture here in a little bit, the Villa Maria site is not usable because the site is almost now too far away from the river. The river shifted over. It's super shallow there. Whatever little pool might have been there is gone. So obviously we're not going to be using that, but there is going to be, there are discussions about moving it upstream. USGS site is the other one in Brian Bush, which we just went through the commissioning effort a week ago or so, and I'll show you some cool pictures. Here's what he, this is what he meant to say, was Cooper's Ridge. I don't know if you guys are looking at this photo. I have not had a chance to see the new Cooper's Ridge site in place, but some of these are fairly, they're pretty interesting looking structures that were developed to, you know, to take the fish from the truck and put them into the river. And the reason is because, as you guys know from the past, some of these sites were difficult to get to. They were off of a bridge, or they had a steep slope involved, but they had good habitat if you get the fish down to them. So, you know, these gigantic elephant trunk things were developed, and the orange thing on the end of that picture is a giant flotation device. I can't speak to the Gordon Rokes. I don't know enough about it, but I think there were some issues about velocities of fish leaving the pipe and skipping along the surface of the river. And anybody else on the phone, if you want to speak to some of these, that's fine. If not, and again, keeping in mind that where there are issues, the Corps has not signed off and said they're done. The idea of this commissioning is over is more of a semantics thing with our construction group versus the contractor, you know, something else. Anyways, I know I'm not too worried about it. USGS site is a very nice deep pool, as you can imagine, for a gauge. And same thing, it's a steep slope, not as steep as the Gordon Road site, as you can see. And I was on that commissioning, and it looked, in my view, it looked generally pretty good. But we did not plant, I think, Greg, we had 12 or 13 fish, something like that.
Yeah, there's only 13.
Yeah, and, you know, we sat and talked about this for an hour after the fish were released, and you can see them swimming back and forth in the little school. So I don't know if, you know, long-term they're going to fare well, but they, at least in my view, they look pretty good. And we did film these sites with cameras that you, I think they're available. And if you want to see them, let me know. I'll send them to you if I can. I think they're fairly large. I know they're large. They're huge. Because they're wave files. And interestingly enough, you can slow them down quite a bit, and not quite as slow as I was hoping, you know, to watch individual fish fly out, but you can really slow them down and get a better sense of what's going on. But we have a really good hydraulic engineer, Steve Schlenker, involved in some of these that are sort of were identified to be trouble issues, and he's out there taking all kinds of calculations. So I think they're working on brainstorming some of the problem areas. Here's the Villa Maria site. I'm not even sure what this picture is, but anyways, there it says pool no longer exists. Release point upstream of leaning tree. And yeah, enough said. The thing's not usable at this point. There's some really good habitat upstream above there, though. Okay, so now we're moving on to the South San Yam and the Gordon Road site. And here's a picture of the Gordon Road site, and this is a fairly short run. I don't know, maybe a 20-foot pipe, and the slope isn't that great. And there was a large rock that was, we feared fish could potentially strike underwater when they hit, so the whole pipe's been shifted over. But as Brett pointed out, and I think it's showing in that lower right-hand picture, there's this white tube of some sort. I'm sure it's got a very, very long name, whatever it's made out of, but it's really, really heavy. And the idea is that thing comes sliding out of the steel tube and then connects to the outlet of the truck, and it's pretty challenging. You know, you have to line that truck up exactly perfectly because there's really no flex in that thing. And I can't speak to these young guys who work at a hatchery, but I know I could put that thing on the thing in a million years. it's probably a minimum two-man job, and everybody, Jeremy's aware of this, and I can't, again, he's not here, so I can't speak to what the next steps are, but I believe they're trying to figure out a way to come up with lighter, you know, equally strong pipe, and we'll see how that goes. All right, we're moving up above Cougar Dam on the McKenzie, sophomore McKenzie. Let's see, I'm going to go straight to the homestead site because that is one where we, again, there was a structure built, as you can see in this picture, and it is another one that's a little bit challenging. These things are very unique in design. If you have an opportunity, all of you should go out and look at these things. But I think the challenge here was that, again, really difficult to get that flexible pipe to marry up to the truck without using two people. And even then, it's like a wrestling match. And the other issue here was that the fish were coming out at a pretty high velocity, and the river was real shallow there. I think that pipe can be adjusted outward, but I don't know how far. And as you can see, there's no flotation at the end of that, so there might be an issue with, you know, these adults striking the bottom of the river. So these things need a little bit of help. All right, so we're moving to the Middle Fork Willamette and Fall Creek now. And this is the Middle Fork Willamette, and this site is simply a hardened site has been there for quite a while. Dan Peck's been using it for a long time. And the Corps went in and hardened it. They widened it and hardened it with gravel and put this gigantic tree across in between two live trees, or, you know, put a log. So the truck can just back right up to it and use its existing pipe that's on the truck, which is essentially like a half chute type thing, and crank it out there and dump the fish off. And I think that one's working okay. Oops. Where are we? And here's the final slide that Jeremy is going to present, which is the upper site on Fall Creek. And it's called Gold Creek, because right across from this picture is Gold Creek tributary that flows into Fall Creek. And as I said, I think this was an old Forest Service road that sort of, maybe at one point it actually crossed the stream and went to the other side. I'm not sure, but a year ago it was basically cut off and truncated where the river had just sort of cut the road off. And there was asphalt underneath there, as I recall. But so we've gone in there and hardened it and put concrete in there, and I think made it so that the truck can just back right down and drop the fish off, but we'll find that out next week when the folks go out there. And all these sites, you know, most of these sites need a little bit of improvement, but I have to give the Corps credit. They went to great efforts to try to, you know, meet the intent of this RPA. If you guys remember, that's why we did this in the first place. It was an RPA in the biological opinion that said you need to identify or improve at least six sites, you know, that are currently used for outplanting, and because none of them work very well, et cetera, et cetera. So the Corps takes this to heart when they read these things, and we try to make these outplant sites as user-friendly for the fish and the operators as possible, but clearly there's more work to be done. Are there any questions at this point? Because if they're not, I'm going to suggest we take a quick 10-minute, 15-minute break and then reconvene and jump into some steelhead discussions. And I know Cam's on the phone now, and he's got some things he wants to present and others. So,
Dave.
Yes, sir.
I do have a question about the South Fork site.
Uh-huh.
Will that be adjusted to be usable in September when we do start taking fish up there? You know, right now, I don't think we want to use it.
You're talking about Homestead?
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know the answer, Kurt, but I'll get back to you on that. I know that Garlitz was asking the same thing, Doug Garlitz.
Right, yeah, because they didn't want to use it either.
Yes. let me look into that and get back to you. And it's my understanding that there is going to be a meeting held very soon with Jeremy, you know, others who were on the design team for this, with Doug and crew. And I'm going to copy you on there. How's that sound? So that you can participate in that.
That'd be fine.
Because we need to, you know, we need to engage everybody, make sure everybody's happy. I know they're planning on very soon now looking at this and reevaluating, but I can't promise anything that's going to be done by September.
Sure. Yeah, it's a pretty short time, but anyway, I appreciate it.
Yep, you bet. Okay, thanks, everybody. So let's take a break. It's 10:50 right now, and why don't we take a break till 11 o'clock and then reconvene, and we'll jump into some of the Steelhead stuff. And we'll leave the phone line open. Okay, thanks, guys. Oh, my heavens.
So, yeah.
Thank you, Tammy.